While the Germans demonstrate that the structural conditions of complete freedom and domination do not produce eliminationist onslaughts differing brutality and cruelty, they also show that such conditions do not instigate the brutality. There are two parts to this point. First, wildly different structural conditions are compatible with enormous brutality. As we know, the German perpetrators, the overwhelming majority being not SS or Nazi Party members, came from all social backgrounds and constituted a representative cross-section of German society, making them ordinary Germans of their time. They also traveled widely varying institutional paths to becoming mass murderers. They served in the most varied range of killing and eliminationist institutions and settings, in camps, ghettos, mobile units of various kinds, search and destroy missions, death marches, and more. They did so in geographically and politically disparate locations, in Germany itself, in occupied countries, as part of, in proximity to, and isolated from neighboring communities' peoples. Despite all these different factors, the perpetrators treated Jews in the various institutions of killing nearly uniformly cruelly, always or nearly always with immense surplus physical brutality, symbolic degradation, and mockery. As the other factors vary, only their common demonological conception of the Jews can explain the Germans' relatively uniform conduct. Second, similar structural conditions, such as of guards having absolute power over victims in camps, have not produced similarly widespread and intensive cruelty everywhere. As brutal, harsh, and deadly as the gulags' living, sanitation, and nutritional conditions were, incessant cruelty paralleling the Germans' cruelty toward the Jews, and to a lesser extent putative subhumans, was absent. The Germans manning camps, as in Majdanek, Lipova, and many others, literally walked around with whips in hand, using them liberally. This was unthinkable for the gulag's guards. A far more brutal and, for the guards, behaviorally permissive ideational regime governed the Germans' camps, but the gulag personnel's comparative restraint toward the prisoners did not artificially result from imposed regulations holding back hate-filled guards chomping at the bit. The perpetrators' variable treatment of victims in the same structural conditions, their fundamental capacity to govern their own cruelty, and the ideational sources of both cruelty and its variability could be seen repeatedly in the gulag, as former prisoners attest. The guards were like everyone, all different, explains Galina Smirnova. There were six sadists and there were completely normal good people, reports Anna Andreeva. The gulag's guards, who were brutal to the prisoners, were so because of what they believed the prisoners to be and to deserve. Not being so ideologized as the Germans were toward Jews, the gulag's personnel were able, more quickly or slowly, to see reality. The prisoners were not as the regime's ideology portrayed. Even the worst guards, at first acting like beasts, grew to treat the prisoners better, as Irina Arginskaya, a former prisoner, explains, because after a time they began to understand, not all of them, but a large part, and they often changed. Once altering their own conception of the victims, they, governing their own conduct and cruelty, concomitantly diminished their treatment's severity. More generally, though the gulag's guards were very hard on the prisoners, as befit their status, they did not make gratuitous torture a constituent part of the prisoners' daily world. Ilyich conveys how little he and the others feared such cruelty, explaining that the guards, not even carrying weapons in the camp, left the prisoners alone when not at work. Those accompanying them to work could be cruel, and they often were. But for actual infractions, not gratuitously. If there weren't any violations about which they had warned, then everything was pretty calm. The same can be said of the otherwise brutal and highly lethal Chinese Lao Gai, whose guards are rarely described as intentionally cruel. In the same eliminationist assault, the baseline cruelty and brutality varies somewhat according to settings, the eliminationist institution's character, and local perpetrator cultures. The baseline cruelty also varies owing to individual perpetrators' personalities, taste for violence and suffering, and relationship to the victims, including the variations in their individual conceptions of them. Such onslaughts obviously open the door for sadists to express their sadism, for those hating the victims that much more to inscribe their wrath in the victims' bodies and souls, and for those seeing overt enthusiasm in their common destructive enterprise as an avenue for promotion to mix business with pleasure. The Hutus' butchery of Tutsi was attended by perpetrators' cruelty that was Nazi-like, and in the frequency of wanton literal butchery, exceeded what the Germans did to Jews. Yet the existing record reveals that, as with the Germans toward the Jews, and as with the overwhelming majority of perpetrators of mass slaughters, the Hutus' individual cruelty was almost always voluntary. Elie Mazinge, a Hutu killer, explains, "Making someone suffer was up to each person, as long as he did his job. The intimidators gave no particular order to encourage or discourage it. They repeated, 'Just kill, that is the main thing.' We didn't care. If a colleague had to play around with a victim, we kept going." Every exterminationist and eliminationist assault has its own particular baseline level of excess cruelty, its own taste for barbarity, its own, so aptly put by Elie, playing around with victims, with the cruelty perpetrated in a given individual killing institution and by individual perpetrators varying, sometimes enormously, from that baseline. Surveying the vast world of perpetrators' excess cruelty suggests five central kinds, which can be called Conradian, Zimbardoian, condign, vengeful, and Machiavellian. Conradian cruelty, after Joseph Conrad's anti-hero Kurtz in The Heart of Darkness, is cruelty of the beast within humans unleashed. Remove civilization's restraints, so goes the thinking, and man or woman lets loose upon his victims his basest, primordial passions. This sort of cruelty, it seems, has unreflectively been assumed to be at work in all exterminationist and eliminationist assaults in a more or less expected and undifferentiated way, so much so that the need to investigate excess cruelty's nature and incidence has all but escaped our analytic view. But this assumption cannot hold. As we know, not all people harbor such beasts, or are all equally beastly. In particular, there is variation in beastliness across cultures and subcultures. Nor do all people visit their base impulses upon all victims equally. That is one reason excess cruelty varies enormously from one eliminationist assault to the next, and also across a given eliminationist program's terrain. Nevertheless, Conrad correctly identified some people's behavioral metamorphosis when civilization's restraints are unloosed, especially against people considered subhumans. A second type of cruelty is Zimbardoian, after the prison experiments Philip Zimbardo conducted at Stanford University, showing that when college students were assigned roles as prison guards and prisoners, the guards, in order to control the non-compliant prisoners, instituted a strict and brutal regime. Structural conditions within camps, or even of rounding up victims and deporting them, can produce excessive cruelty serving operational domination. And although Zimbardo's experiment was too artificial, brief, 6 days, and limited in number, 24, and type of participants, Stanford University undergraduates, to know much about its general validity or what it actually reveals, the structural situation it sought to capture can clearly produce conduct in some people having no prior animus toward the victims. For several reasons, Zimbardoian cruelty is probably a less frequent kind during eliminationist assaults, and it could not possibly be, as is commonly postulated, the general source of perpetrators' brutality. In many, including Indonesia, Burundi, and Rwanda, the perpetrator's task is to kill their victims immediately. This requires no Zimbardoian control mechanisms. Yet they torture, beat, degrade, and taunt their victims anyway. In fact, in killing their victims, which by definition has nothing to do with establishing dominance for present and future control, the perpetrators of these and other mass murders often butchered them in maximally painful ways, deriving pleasure from their suffering. Eliminationist programs' most non-explicitly murderous aspects in Turkey, German-dominated Europe, Japanese-dominated Asia, the Soviet Union, China, Cambodia, Guatemala, Sudan, and elsewhere, whether they are employing camps, death marches, or other mechanisms, usually have perpetrators controlling or herding a weakened, overwhelmed, unthreatening, and pliant population, including children. The actual or psychological need to respond to victims' challenges or even to preemptively dragoon them is simply non-existent. So a mechanism based on such a need's existence could not produce the perpetrator's actual vast and gleeful cruelty. In many eliminationist settings, even in camps, ironically the institutions most approximating the prison Zimbardo constructed, the utterly powerless and defenseless prisoners, unlike Zimbardo's actively rebellious Stanford University student prisoners, soon to return to their privileged existences on their country club campus, are as a rule cowed and compliant. Finally, if a Zimbardoian mechanism or some other social, psychological mechanism or setting generally generates the perpetrator's cruelty, then each individual eliminationist assault and the variety of eliminationist assaults should generate substantial variation in cruelty according to the Zimbardoian character of the setting of each small group of perpetrators. Even a cursory knowledge of eliminationist assaults shows that this is false. The third kind of cruelty, condign, emerges from the perpetrator's belief that the beings they confront and are eliminating deserve to suffer. In this case, excess cruelty in all its forms, beatings, systematic torture, inventive, even playful, painful use of the victims, actual and symbolic degradation, verbal taunting and mocking, are not the individual expression of human nature exposed as in Conradian cruelty, or of human nature awry as in individual psychopathology. Condign cruelty is begotten of the normative view that treating the victims in this manner is right and fitting, and desisting from inflicting pain on them would violate what the victim's inherent nature requires. Flowing from the perpetrator's conception of the victims, this kind of cruelty could also be called ideological cruelty. But it is a specific kind of ideological cruelty with a strong normative core, suggesting to the perpetrator that he fulfills a moral imperative to make the victims suffer. Vengeful cruelty merges passion with self-righteousness. A striking feature of eliminationist assaults is that the perpetrators and the social groups they come from, represent, and in whose name they act, regularly conceive of themselves as reacting rather than acting. Believing that the victims have already perpetrated or intend to perpetrate great injury upon them, they understand their assault as essentially defensive, necessary to forestall further harm, rather than as offensive against an unthreatening party. Perpetrators and their supporters ease in convincing themselves they are justly giving the victims what they had inflicted or would inflict upon them when it is overwhelmingly evident that this is wrong, demonstrates human beings' great vulnerability to prejudices and ideologies positing that a disparaged, hated, or alien group poses a dire threat. This sense of victimhood, the rage it induces, and the perpetrator's self-righteousness in administering hard justice combine to produce an appetite for vengeance and pleasure in meting it out. Vengeful cruelty. Analyzing the Khmer Rouge perpetrators, Vaughn reports that 99% of them were cruel. Why? They just wanted to revenge themselves on the new people. By ideological definition, the new people were rich, imperialist exploiters of the true Khmer. Thus, as Jung explains, the Khmer Rouge took revenge against them. They just enjoyed torturing those rich people that lived the easy life. You know, the imperialist people. Soviet front newspapers urged soldiers to record in a Book of Revenge, their and their family's suffering, to ready themselves to treat the Germans as they supposedly deserved. The Supreme Soviet Military Commander, Marshal Grigory Zhukov's orders to his armies before a major offensive in January 1945 echoed this theme. "Woe to the land of the murderers," the orders told the men. "We will get our terrible revenge for everything." In an archetypical way, Soviet road signs in eastern Germany encouraged the already willing soldiers to exact their personal tolls on the Germans whose country and army, but not the individual women whom the Soviets raped in enormous numbers, had made the Soviet peoples suffer. "Soldier, you are in Germany. Take revenge on the Hitlerites." With a cruel teacher's relish to a recalcitrant and transgressive student, perpetrators whip their victims, shouting, "You will learn." What will the victims learn? What it means to suffer as they supposedly made others suffer. What it means to be subjected to the wrath of their betters, their masters. What truth and justice in the perpetrator's eyes means. Eliminationist perpetrators frequently practice vengeful cruelty, though, as with cruelty's other forms, variably. While excess cruelty's other forms seem to contain rage at the victims for not bending to the perpetrator's will or for, owing to the victim's own putative misconduct, obliging the perpetrators to act in an ordinarily antisocial and punishable way, vengeful cruelty contains this rageful element constitutively. There appears to be a basis grounded in the nature of experience and in neurology for this excessive rage, even according to what the perpetrators claim to have suffered, and its excessive application, which context and other emotions amplify. Suffering, real or imagined, to the perpetrator himself or through identification with that of his family, social circle, or wider community, becomes amplified because it is his suffering, always more intensely felt, more real in effect, and more powerful in impact than other people's suffering. Even if the perpetrator seeks to mete out mere rough justice, exactly proportionate to his own suffering, he will subject his victim to considerably more pain because experientially only an added hefty dose seems to equal his own. But as we know, the perpetrators do not choose to practice strict proportionality, but to make their victims suffer according to their own liberally cruel psychological and emotional needs. Even so, owing to this and other cognitive and psychological mechanisms, the perpetrators underestimate their victims' suffering. Thus, to achieve the retributive satisfaction they crave, they brutalize their victims still more. And the more the victim comprehends he deserves this suffering, and the more intense it is, the more satisfying its infliction is. Finally, there is Machiavellian cruelty, which, true to Machiavelli's clear-eyed, heartless advice to rulers in The Prince, is politically calculated brutality to advance cogent strategic or tactical goals. Perpetrators use such cruelty to terrorize targeted peoples, to bend them to the perpetrator's eliminationist will, or to systematically scar the victims physically and emotionally so as to diminish them and their putative danger. Classic instances are torturing a person to extract information, flogging camp inmates before the assembled prisoners to convey the price of resistance or disobedience, and publicly torturing members of targeted communities so others know what awaits them if they do not heal, or, as in eliminationist expulsions, cooperate and flee. Each kind of excess cruelty has a different source and is grounded in a different aspect of personal or social life. Conradian cruelty originates in aspects of human nature, humanity's capacities and dispositions developed through evolution, which presumably are relatively constant across humanity, and in the psychological and social psychological dispositions common to a society's or culture's members, which vary enormously. There does appear to be some fundamental and widely distributed human capacity to be cruel, to vent the passions civilization normally constrains, perhaps even more intensively because they ordinarily do not find outlets. But this general capacity and propensity, whatever it is, to express itself, does not explain why cruelty comes out in different eliminationist assaults and in different settings by different perpetrators toward different victims to differing degrees. Different cultures socialize people with different emotional stances toward others' suffering, different tastes for violence and brutality, and with different practices toward outgroups, not to mention toward enemies. When restraints are lifted, when people are licensed to do as they please with others, what people of different societies and cultures will happily do varies enormously. Human nature must be a powerful source of eliminationist onslaught's cruelty, but it hardly explains cruelty's character, quantity, and distribution across such political practice. Even adding perpetrators' social and cultural differences would explain only part of the variation. Zimbardoian cruelty emerges from the structure of relations, namely the dynamic of the conflict between guards for domination and prisoners to resist or free themselves. It is the structure, the guards' objective and then psychologically grafted need to keep the prisoners cowed, that leads them to adopt brutal practices. Condign cruelty is grounded in norms of right conduct, which, though perverted or inverted according to our moral compass, guide the executioners, administrators of subjectively just and necessary sentences of suffering, as other moral norms have guided religious crusaders of various kinds. Across cultures, criminals would be punished even if they no longer posed a threat, and punishing them had no deterrent value, merely because people believe those committing crimes deserve punishment. In some societies and cultures, historically and today, the further moral belief has broadly existed that criminals' punishment should be hard, and they should suffer to a greater or lesser degree. So, too, the practitioner of condign cruelty is animated to make the criminals before him suffer. Vengeful cruelty is grounded in experience, the experience of one's own people's suffering at the hands of one's victims. The experience may be real, the Soviet peoples did actually suffer at the Germans' hands, but it is usually figmental, derived from the perpetrator's prior prejudices about their victims. Even if real, the perpetrators typically magnify the suffering wildly and apply responsibility for it so indiscriminately to the target group, according to the blanket, unforgiving, and even paranoid thinking of the perpetrators' prejudices, racism, and hatreds, that the kernel of truth that may seed the perpetrators' vast fury is barely relevant for understanding the perpetrators' brutality. Experience in this context does not mean the individual perpetrator's experience, but almost always his knowledge, faulty though it may be, acquired from others about the victim's putative harming of him, his people, or his ethnic group, society, or country. The perpetrator comes to experience these supposed injuries as if they had been done to him or a loved one, or as if they are in the offing, producing in him the rage of people being physically or otherwise attacked or threatened. This sense of injury or danger can well up inside the perpetrator whenever he confronts or thinks of confronting his victims. Machiavellian or purposeful cruelty is grounded in eliminationist aims beyond the immediate gratification of passions, self-expression, or the structuring of relations between the perpetrator and his victims. It is a consciously calculated choice and strategy to achieve a well-defined goal. These five kinds of excess cruelty are grounded in five sources: Conradian in human nature, Zimbardoian in social relations, condign in moral norms, vengeful in collective experience, and Machiavellian in political aims. Each source, and thus each kind of cruelty, is sociological, having nothing to do with the individual perpetrator's personality or psychology. They are patterned forms of excess cruelty within the cognitively and politically unleashed eliminationist project, the prerequisite of which is the perpetrator's conceiving of the targets as people deserving elimination. Two of them, Zimbardoian and Machiavellian, can further be called instrumental cruelty, in that they have some conventionally understood purpose other than, or often in addition to, the victim's suffering itself or the satisfaction of teaching the victims a lesson. Ruin Sam recounts an instance when the instrumental purpose of the Khmer Rouge's cruelty supplemented the perpetrator's satisfaction derived from their treatment of a Khmer who enraged his tormentors when, instead of gratifying them by providing a show confession in front of assembled children prisoners, he, protesting his innocence, accused the Khmer Rouge of injustice. Suddenly, one of them hit him from the back, pushing him, and he fell face to the ground. It was raining. We sat in the rain, and then the rain became blood. He was hit with a shovel, and then he went unconscious and began to have a seizure. Then Anka, the Khmer Rouge, took out a sharp knife and cut the man from his breastbone all the way down to his stomach. They took out his organs. When I saw this, I felt so shocked, like I was blind. It felt like they were hitting me just as they hit the prisoner. The person cut him open and took a sharp piece of wire and stuck it in what I think was the liver and the bowels. They tied the organs with wire on the handlebars of a bicycle and biked away, leaving a bloody trail. Anka calmly told us over the microphone, "All girls and boys, you have seen with your own eyes. If someone feels compassion or sympathy for the enemy that has just died, then you will be punished just like him." Zimbardoian cruelty arises out of the perpetrator's need to control insubordination, which here, with utterly cowed children, was not at issue. Perpetrators use Machiavellian cruelty for strategic political ends, such as terrorizing the victims, here to further dam up the children's compassion. These two forms of instrumental cruelty are by far the least frequent kinds of cruelty in eliminationist assaults, and as in this instance's Machiavellian display, they almost always combine with or are grafted onto other forms of cruelty. The other three far more common kinds of cruelty, all non-instrumental, are ends in themselves, providing psychic satisfaction to the perpetrators. The Tutsi survivor Rowilla Liza, his sociological and psychological knowledge rooted in vast bitter experience, speaks to the Hutu butcher's voluntarism and its utterly non-instrumental sources. "So why did they chop people up instead of killing them straight away? I do not think it was to punish them for having tried to escape, nor to discourage the living from running, from fleeing from the assassins all day long, saving themselves any way they could. Or perhaps they did so for a tiny percentage only. Whatever the case, these villains thought they would end it for us. They chopped us out of a taste for barbarity, nothing more." Each exterminationist and eliminationist assault's brutality is patterned. Within the context of the character of an individual eliminationist program's general cruelty, perpetrators express their shared and individual emotional and psychological, even psychopathological propensities, intensifying or ameliorating that onslaught's baseline brutality in general or its particular settings. Rowilla Liza explains, "Among them there were normal Hutu who killed normally, wicked Hutu who killed wickedly, most often inter Ahamwe. And finally there were extremists in wickedness who killed with extreme wickedness. Sometimes, as among the Jews, Kikuyu, and Tutsi, when survivors describe a particularly cruel perpetrator, they take their tormentor's enormous baseline cruelty so much for granted that they remark upon the perpetrator's routine cruelty in passing, as an ordinary expectation. One Jewish victim, a woman, reports that in her camp, Wagner was a sadist. He would not only beat the women, that was done by all the SS men. She explains further, "He was active not with a gun, but with a whip, and he frequently beat women so terribly that they died of the effects. In his sadism towards women, Wagner appeared to us to be absolutely abnormal. The other SS men who held total power over us were, of course, also very cruel, but were not sadistic in the same way as Wagner. In principle, we could construct a better understanding, singly and comparatively, of perpetrators' cruelty by systematically collecting and analyzing all relevant data in light of cruelty's five types and sources. Author's note: in most settings, given current empirical knowledge, and even under better informational conditions, it is difficult to disentangle the mix of cruelty's different types and sources, and to confidently analyze their distribution in a given eliminationist assault, or even in a single camp. We know little about this crucial aspect of the perpetrator's conduct and inner lives, most about the Germans, and increasingly more about the Hutus, because cruelty's precise nature and sources are difficult to fathom, and for the different eliminationist assaults in general, we either have few or no such investigations. Even with our current knowledge, we can understand a great deal about the perpetrator's excess cruelty merely by finally focusing on it and analyzing it according to its variable nature and sources. Substantial correspondence exists between the social theory governing perpetrators' treatment of targeted groups, deriving from their conception of them, and their excessive cruelty's character. Perpetrators almost always see existential enemies as having inflicted great injury upon them and their society, and, by definition, of wanting to continue. The perpetrators are in a rage. In their eyes, the eliminationist assaults are almost by definition retributive. The social theory that tends to inform the perpetrator's treatment of existential enemies is realpolitik, which complements their aggressions and desire to wreak vengeance with a sense that they must be brutal to their victims, not necessarily in a calculated way, but almost as a constituent aspect of their relations with them, to keep them down and in check. Perpetrators approach putative subhumans with a utilitarian social theory akin to using implements, animals, and things, with one critical difference. Because the putative subhumans have understanding, speak, and display subhuman emotions, the perpetrators can take pleasure in mistreating them, in being cruel to them, as they cannot for things or implements or even animals. Because they conceive the victims to lack some fundamental human quality, their eliminationist assaults tend to produce the purest Conradian brutality, allowing the perpetrators, absent civilization's restraints, to repeatedly express and sate their most violent urges. Their cruelty towards subhumans has two additional aspects. The perpetrators, because their conception of humanity dehumanizes others, are already enmeshed in a brutalizing worldview that inhibits fellow feeling and promotes licentiousness and their taking out of their otherwise bottled up aggression and urges on the subhuman victims and playthings. Someone unable to kick his boss might kick his dog, or anger quickly at his children, or punch a wall or rip something up. Such a dynamic affected the Japanese perpetrators in Nanjing and across their Asian empire, especially soldiers. As masters of colonial subhumans, they acted upon the pent-up resentment and rage at their own cultures and institutions' brutal treatment of them. They butchered their victims with abandon and glee. John Rabe, the German businessman documenting in his diary the Japanese's predations in Nanjing, recorded that the same reports are coming in from all sides in the region about rapes, murder, and mayhem, leading him to observe that one might be led to think that the entire criminal population of Japan is in uniform here. The perpetrators of eliminationist violence against putative subhumans, including the Japanese perpetrators, come from societies and cultures that do not recognize human beings' universal and intrinsic moral equality. In their eyes, the victims have rendered themselves fit and necessary to be eliminated, not by contingent beliefs or actions, but intrinsically by the danger of their diminished human, in other words, subhuman, essence. In such contexts, though anything is permissible, cruelty is not necessary. The perpetrators have nothing more complex to teach the subhumans about their place than they would a pack of dogs. Perpetrators assaulting demonized victims, whether heretics who are demonized or demons who are demonized and dehumanized, tend to express condign cruelty, wanting to treat their victims according to, in the case of heretics, their eschatological moral theory, or in the case of demons, their inverted Kantian morality. The brutality is often justified according to a well-articulated ideology and moral theory about treating or instructing the miscreants about the one true path they unconscionably oppose. Demons and heretics must suffer at the hands of their betters, goodness's guardians. Only then will they come to know their way's error, apostasy, inhumanity. The members of the perpetrators' communities are welcome to know and to watch all this, so they too can feel righteous and even, as in the Rwandan village's torture jamborees, learn from these torments. The particular social and moral theories governing the perpetrators can produce widely differing expressions of brutality, from the Soviets' comparatively low incidence of excess cruelty to the Germans' and the Hutus' virtually boundless cruelty toward, respectively, the putatively irredeemable Jews and Tutsi. Whatever the central tendencies of perpetrators' cruelty during each kind of eliminationist assault, perpetrators frequently convince themselves that, whatever else they do, they also avenge or prophylactically prevent heinous crimes against themselves and their societies. Thus, vengeful cruelty, rooted in this imagined experience, exists across eliminationist assaults. If Conradian cruelty has central tendencies, though also a potential near ubiquity, if Zimbardoian cruelty appears only in selected circumstances, if condign cruelty is an attribute of the slayers and eliminators of demons and heretics, and if vengeful cruelty also has its central tendencies and ubiquity, Machiavellian cruelty of political aims is least patterned. As all eliminationist assaults are political, Machiavellian cruelty could inherently be produced in any of them. Yet such cruelty appears only when the leaders and their followers choose to conceptualize excess cruelty as a political instrument, which, like eliminationist slaughters themselves, is unpredictable and happens less frequently than might be supposed. Whenever a perpetrator strikes a victim with the instrumental purpose of affecting, including by terrorizing, other victims, or of weakening the victim group, it is politically motivated excess cruelty. This kind of cruelty, like other widespread cruelties have such consequences, might, as its explicit purpose is eliminationist, also be conceptualized as an eliminationist means in its own right, and not just an eliminationist assault's complement or byproduct. But however we conceive it, politically inspired cruelty often appears in conjunction with cruelty's other forms, meaning cruelty's infliction has mixed sources, motives, and types, which complicates the isolation and identification of Machiavellian cruelty's presence. Aside from these general kinds of cruelty, perpetrators reserve certain cruelties for certain specific members of targeted people or groups. If far too little attention is devoted to collecting information on, publicizing, and analyzing perpetrators' cruelty in general, still less attention goes to perpetrators' cruelty towards specific subgroups of victims. Perpetrators often target two such kinds of victims, women and children, with specific horrors, though their deeds are little recognized and not conceptualized and analyzed as specific instances of cruelty. This failure reflects the general lack of attentive analysis given to the perpetrator's acts in general. Almost all studies focus on killing, but not the perpetrator's manner of killing, general treatment of the victims, or other acts. Yet it also reflects women's and children's general invisibility as distinct victim groups. Women's and children's particularity cannot rightly be ignored by subsuming them under the general category of victims, or by treating them as no different from men. The perpetrator's particular treatment of and cruelty toward women and children, perhaps even more than general cruelty, has not been focused upon, probably for another reason. Doing so reveals the hollowness of so much existing analysis. Perpetrators' sexual cruelty toward women of targeted groups, though vast, is generally poorly documented and significantly underanalyzed. For decades, really throughout the past, such cruelty has been treated, if deemed noteworthy at all, as an otherwise non-significant byproduct of war and other assaults, and of men's nature. With the feminist revolution in the 1960s and 1970s, and the concomitant discovery of women and gender as historical and political subjects, the intellectual space opened up for devoting proper attention to eliminationist assaults' sexual cruelty, the most common kind being rape. Nevertheless, in retrospect, it took longer than might have been expected, especially as the Pakistanis' vast sexual cruelty against Bangladeshi women in 1971 was contemporaneously recognized. Only in the 20th century's last decade did people begin to understand such cruelty as often being politically inspired, Machiavellian in the term's fullest, most dastardly and cruelest sense. Such politically inspired cruelty's classical instance, it was here the phenomenon was first discovered and became an investigative theme, was the Serbs' sexual cruelty against Bosniak women and later against Kosovar women. Serbs, during their eliminationist assault in Bosnia, killed many military-age men and expelled others from their villages and regions. They also decided to systematically rape Muslim women as another means of undermining the Bosniak people. They physically and/or emotionally maimed a huge number of individual women, their families, who in this shame culture had to absorb the shame, and Bosniak society itself, which treated raped women as polluted and untouchable. Knowing this, Serbs calculated that the more women they raped, the more the number of reproductive Bosniak women and future Bosniak generations would decline. The rape's political purposefulness and central organization is clear. Melika Kreitmeier, the doctor leading a gynecological team that examined 25 victims, reports that the rapes were meant to humiliate Muslim women, to insult them, to destroy their persons, and to cause shock. These women were raped not because it was the male instinct. They were raped because it was the goal of the war. She adds, "My impression is that someone had an order to rape the girls." An impression the victims corroborate, recounting their rapists explicitly telling them they were on a mission. To achieve their political ends, the Serbs set up rape camps, where soldiers, paramilitary troops, and others could regularly rape the women. Serb rape gangs roamed Bosnia. The Serbian leadership essentially green-lighted any Serb to rape any Muslim woman anywhere. After impregnating Muslim women, which was also this cruelty's explicit political purpose, the Serbs often incarcerated them until they could no longer safely terminate the pregnancy, forcing them to bear children of Serbian men whom they, and apparently many Bosniaks, believed would weaken and dilute the Bosniak people. "We're bringing you to a concentration camp," one Bosniak woman reports being told. "The next time we meet, you'll have one of our kids in your belly." A Serb she knew prior to the eliminationist campaign raped her, saying, "I was the 100th one to be raped anyway in that camp, and I certainly wouldn't be the last." In this political campaign of sexual cruelty, Serbs raped between 20,000 and 50,000 women, many of them dozens of times.